Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with North Korea's bellicose response to a new round of UN sanctions imposed as a result of a recent North Korean nuclear test. Charles Armstrong, the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and author of the forthcoming book Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990, joins us to discuss North Korea's threat of a nuclear strike against the United States. Then we'll speak with Dr. Robert Lustig, the country's leading expert on childhood obesity and its connection to high fructose corn syrup and sugar that is prominent in processed food. We will discuss Dr. Lustig's new book, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease, and whether American consumers can free themselves from the corporate food products that are killing them. Then finally, we'll examine the latest filibuster against President Obama's nominee to fill John Roberts' seat on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit that has been vacant since 2005 due to the routine and consistent use of the filibuster by Republican senators. Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, joins us to discuss how Mitch McConnell's brazen obstruction of Obama's judicial nominees has slanted the federal judiciary in a heavily conservative direction. Joining us now is Charles Armstrong, who is a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945-1950, A History of the Peninsula's, titled simply The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book out soon is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Nice to be with you.
And obviously, North Korea has said provocative things in the past, they haven't really responded to the UN sanctions, which were passed, by the way, with a 15-0 vote on the Security Council. And they were crafted and drafted with the United States and China, North Korea's principal ally. Do you expect more statements to come forth, short of the more recent one that threatened nuclear war?
We can expect more provocative statements. Certainly, North Korea has made them many times in the past when it feels that it is threatened, and we haven't seen it actually take action for the most part. You know, so we can't take their overheated rhetoric all too seriously. But we are entering, I think, a very potentially dangerous situation, and there is the possibility, not of a nuclear attack on the U.S., which I think North Korea is not capable of and is not foolish enough to attempt, but more small-scale actions on the Korean Peninsula between North and South. That's actually what concerns me more than the possibility of a nuclear war.
Well, on Wednesday, there was a fairly blunt response from the South Korean army general, who called a news conference and warned that if South Korea were provoked, they would strike back at top North Korean military leadership. And of course, in 2010, there was an exchange of artillery fire raining down on a South Korean island. And prior to that, a South Korean warship was sunk with a loss of 46 South Korean sailors, I should say. So, is that an escalation? Is that different? The South has quite often been quite restrained in their response to North Korean provocations.
Yes, they have. But in fact, many people in South Korea feel they were too restrained in 2010 and should have taken stronger action. There's a new president in South Korea who comes from a right-of-center party, and I think there's a lot of pressure on her to stand up to North Korea and be tough. That could lead to a situation where if there is a provocation or even a sense of a potential provocation from the North, the South could respond and things could escalate very quickly and very dangerously.
So, again, I'm speaking with Charles Armstrong. He's a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His latest book out soon is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. The fact that the North Korean television feature General Kim Yong-chol, who's the head of North Korea's military intelligence, he's apparently a hardliner that South Korean officials have felt was involved in these 2010 attacks. And he was the person who read one of these provocative statements on television, threatening on Tuesday to use lighter and smaller nukes against the United States. Did you give us a sense of reading the tea leaves there? And the conventional wisdom is that this dynasty, of the Kim family dynasty, the new 28-year-old leader is not tested yet, and he has to show his bones, and maybe he's being provoked by his own military. I mean, how do you read it?
I think that there is some truth to that. He is a new, young leader. The old military guard is still there to a great extent, although there have been some personnel changes. He has to show that he's tough, that he's standing up to the Americans, to the South Koreans. And a lot of what they say is intended for domestic consumption as much as it is for an international audience. Having said that, I think that Kim Jong-un does inherit his father's desire to demonstrate North Korea's military power, that he went ahead with the nuclear test explicitly on his father's orders. One of his last wishes before he died in 2011 was that they would carry out these satellite launches and nuclear tests. And I don't think we should make too much of the differences between Kim Jong-un and the rest of the leadership. They are, I think, generally united on showing a very strong front to the outside world, and in particular responding very forcefully to the threat of sanctions, which now apparently will be put into force.
But the sanctions seem to be specifically targeted against them and against the patronage system that the Kim family have in buying the loyalty, if indeed they have to. I mean, I've often wondered, there's this specialist on South Korea, Brian Myers, has written a book suggesting that in many ways we've got it wrong here in the West in analyzing and labeling this North Korean regime as a kind of Stalinist throwback, when in fact it may be more similar to the Imperial Japanese regime in the 1930s. So do you agree with Brian Myers that the definitions aren't very precise about what kind of regime this is?
I think I agree to the extent that we do misunderstand North Korea as a Stalinist regime. It's a highly personalist, family-oriented regime, and in that sense, it's actually very different from the Imperial Japan wartime regime, which was, although it had a symbolic emperor, he himself did not have the kind of power, and his family did not have the kind of highly concentrated, personalized power that we have in North Korea today. Furthermore, North Korea is not an expansionist, imperialist power like Japan was. It is a very defensive country that sees itself surrounded by these hostile forces, in which I think the leadership, to a certain extent, generally believes are out to destroy them. So they've managed to survive for 60 years, for 20 years now, after the fall of the Soviet Union. So I think to simply see them as a kind of leftover of communism is a misunderstanding. They're a very tough, xenophobic, nationalistic regime, and they have to be taken seriously.
But at the end of the day, we keep ratcheting up sanctions, and under President George W. Bush, he called them names, and eventually, after you've done all the posturing, you still have to sort of go back to dealing with them. And the only people that appear to be able to have any leverage are the Chinese. And a lot of analysts are now suggesting that these new round of sanctions that have been largely crafted by the Chinese at the United Nations Security Council may indicate a change of attitude on the part of the Chinese. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, it might. We'll have to see. So far, the Chinese haven't been very forthcoming with putting into practice the sanctions that they've signed on to. These sanctions look tough on paper, but in reality, if China isn't willing to go through with them, they're not going to have much of an effect. But it's also not clear what their effect could be even if they were put into practice. They're not going to undo the nuclear weapons that North Korea has already made. They could be intended to punish them, but they're not going to stop, although they may slow down its nuclear program going forward. So at the same time, and the Chinese, as well as the Russians, have said this, we need a more comprehensive strategy that includes the possibility of diplomacy and negotiating with these people. Sanctions, even targeted sanctions like this, are not going to really change their behavior unless there's a way out. Backing North Korea into a corner is not a very good strategy and can, in fact, lead to some very unpleasant results.
So what about the idea that these sanctions are, targeting the elite, and what I assume is a kind of patronage system that the family use to buy loyalty, if short of the sort of godlike adulation that they have. You know, they're banning, for example, the export of expensive jewelry, yachts, luxury automobiles, racing cars, etc. And they're also forcing the North Koreans to carry around large suitcases filled with cash, moving their illicit funds. And the resolution also requires states to inspect suspect cargo on their territory and prevent any vessel that refuses an inspection from entering their ports. And new aviation measures, which call on UN states to deny aircraft permission to take off land or fly over their territory if illicit cargo is suspected to be aboard. So at least on paper, that seems like the squeeze is on a little.
Yes, it does. But again, we'll see how it actually is put into practice. The last time I visited Pyongyang, there were plenty of foreign cars and other things in the capital of North Korea that are supposedly banned by previous sanctions. But the other question, and the more important question, is even if the sanctions do work, what effect will they have? Do we really believe that if the elite of North Korea don't get their cognac and can't buy their yachts, that they're going to rise up or they're going to pressure Kim Jong-un to behave differently? I somehow doubt that. These sorts of pressures only have a certain limited effect. We also have to have some kind of a channel of negotiating our way out of this. Otherwise, the status quo will just continue for a long time. And part of the sanctions will definitely hurt a lot of the population of North Korea after resources are diverted now to an elite that doesn't have the access they had before. So it's not necessarily the case that even the people who are the intended targets of these sanctions are really going to be hurt that badly.
So what are we playing, some kind of shadow game here to satisfy ourselves? Because quite often it seems that sanctions have to do with more with the side that's imposing the sanctions. They do it out of frustration. They can't do anything else. And it's made us feel good that we're doing something. But you've just described the possibility that one will be counterproductive it will hurt the people even more, because more of the scarce food, et cetera, will be diverted to the elites. And it seems to me that it comes on the North Korean side. They simply want America to acknowledge this regime and accept it. And is that where the lines are drawn between us finding that this is so unsavory, this regime, that we can't acknowledge it give it the respect that it is demanding, and having tantrums every time you don't give them what they want? Or and conversely, you know, does it come down to that's what they want, to be legitimized?
Yes, I think that to a great extent is what they want, but it's a very difficult way of expressing what they want, and it's certainly extremely difficult for the U.S. to accept North Korea and many other countries to accept North Korea as a nuclear power. But I think that's true. North Korea wants to be recognized by the United States. It wants to be taken seriously. And the strategy that the Obama administration has taken, which they've called strategic patience, is basically ignoring North Korea, and I don't think that's going to get us anywhere. Sanctions are being put into place to some extent because that's what we said we would do. That's what the U.S. threatened to do if North Korea had a nuclear test, so we have to carry this out. But it's not clear to me that there really is a serious and well-considered end game for where this will lead. It's not, as I said, going to get rid of North Korea's nuclear weapons, and it's not going to really solve the pressing problems of security and economic instability in North Korea. We have to have other ways to do that.
And Charles Armstrong, the assumption is that the Chinese have leverage, but I imagine that at least within the Chinese military, the hardliners probably are perfectly happy to have North Korea drive the Americans crazy. And they also don't want a collapsed regime in the North, which would mean that the U.S. military would be on the Yellow River again. So is that a factor? I mean, what keeps China supporting this regime that clearly is annoying it at the moment?
Well, there are different feelings within the Chinese leadership. There is a great deal of frustration about North Korea's behavior. China explicitly told North Korea before the nuclear test in February not to go through with this, and they did. But there's only so much China can do. As they keep saying, North Korea won't buckle down and do what you tell them just because you have economic leverage. They're a tough customer. There also is an element within China that is most concerned about instability in North Korea, and above all, as you say, they don't want to see North Korea collapse and the U.S. military up on their border on the Yalu River. So North Korea is a convenient buffer for them. They want to not allow North Korea to go forward with these provocative sorts of actions, but they don't want to pressure them so much that the regime becomes unstable or even collapses.
So at this point, Charles Armstrong, again, professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and the author of the forthcoming book out soon, Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Does this situation come down to, in spite of the threats of nuclear war against the United States, which the U.S. is quick to say they can handle, I forgot to mention that we had the basketball player from the Chicago Bulls there recently in North Korea coming back saying that Kim Jong-un doesn't want to do war. Mm-hmm. I'm quoting exactly what he said. But it looks like if they want to do any kind of war, it'll be with the South or it'll be some kind of provocation. And is that what worries you, the possibility that the South are also pretty hardline at the moment and next time around, they may not roll over and be accommodating?
Yes, as I said, there's a new administration in the South as well, a new president who's untested, who is the first female president of South Korea. And she will be under pressure to respond forcefully to the North if there's a future provocation. And even what North Korea has done and said it would do so far is, in a sense, a provocation to South Korea. So we have to be very careful going forward of something escalating out of control. For example, the U.S.-South Korean military exercises going on have evoked some pretty bellicose language from North Korea. And it was in that context in November 2010 that North Korea lobbed artillery shells at the South Korean island of Yeonpyeong. They said it was because of these military exercises South Korea and the U.S. were doing in the area. So I think that is the real danger, much more than North Korea one day launching a nuclear missile at Washington, which is it is incapable of doing anyway.
Well, Charles Armstrong, I thank you very much for joining us here.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, who is a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book out soon is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking to the country's leading researcher in the causes of childhood obesity.
Oh, to live on Sugar Mountain with the barkers and the colored balloons. You can't be 20 on Sugar Mountain, though you're thinking that you're leaving there too soon. You're leaving there too soon.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Lustig, who is a pediatric endocrinologist who has spent the past 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He is the director of the Weight Assessment for Teens and Child Health Program at the University of California, San Francisco's Benioff Children's Hospital, a member of the UCSF's Institute for Health Policy Studies, and a member of the Obesity Task Force of both the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. His latest book just out is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Robert Lustig.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And your lecture some time back on sugar as a toxin got an enormous amount of attention. We were grateful that we were able to offer it up in our fund drive when it came out a few years back, and it got several million hits on YouTube.
Blows me away.
It does, but you know, on the other hand, we learned, for example, that the heads of the world's largest processed food companies, Coca-Cola and Nabisco, they all met at Pillsbury headquarters back in 1999, mm-hmm. and they were told, they were given a briefing saying that their food is the reason for the epidemic of obesity in this country, and right. they clearly decided not to deal with it.
They've hunkered down, you know. They basically know what's going on. Whether they knew the science of it or not is not clear, but they certainly knew what was going on. The article in Mother Jones from December of 2012, written by Gary Taubes and Kristen Cousins, chronicles the history of exactly what the food industry knew and when they knew it. And to be honest with you, it's very close to what happened with tobacco. And I guess that shouldn't be too surprising, because after all, what do you think the tobacco companies diversified into?
Exactly. Well, this is a business that makes a $1 trillion a year in sales.
Makes the tobacco industry look like a dwarf.
But at a social cost approaching what, $300-400 billion in.
Well, just yesterday, CNN reported that diabetes costs America $245 billion a year, and that's just diabetes. Never mind the heart disease. Never mind the lipid problems and stroke. Never mind the cancer and dementia.
So it strikes me as being extraordinary that you and others have isolated the cause, the central, or at least the main driver in this country's becoming less and less healthy, and yet it can't be stopped. It can be identified, but not stopped.
Well, here's the deal, Ian, in 10 words or less. It can be stopped, but the food industry obviously doesn't want it stopped, and to be honest with you, the federal government is in bed with the food industry, and there's reasons, obviously, you know, promotion of business. The fact is that 6% of our exports are food. So what would happen if all of a sudden our federal government came out and said, you know, all that sugar that we've been adding to all the food and all the fiber we've been taking out of all the food over all these years, you know, really isn't so healthy for you. What do you think would happen? What happened when that one downer cow went from Canada to Washington State back in 2006? It wasn't even our cow. That was the end of meat sales to Britain and South Korea for 2 years. Bottom line, government's job is to protect the food supply, and that includes protecting it from me and from us, you know, the people who are trying to do something in terms of public health. Ultimately, public health spends dollars. You know, industries makes dollars. The government's job is to help industry do it. This is actually a war between us and them. And I know which side I come down on. I'm a physician. I'm a pediatrician. I take care of obese kids. I watch their lives absolutely go down the tubes. I feel for these kids. And I need to help, you know, use the science to make things better.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist who spent the past 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. And he's the author of the new book just out, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. And not only, of course, are we consuming more sugar than ever, we're eating 33 pounds of cheese, which is triple what we ate in 1970, 70 pounds of sugar, which is 22.
We're eating way more than that of sugar. That's a way low guesstimate. We are more closer to 120 pounds. We were used to be up as high as 142 pounds. We have cut back a little bit because we have switched to diet drinks to some extent. 42% of all soft drinks sold in America now are of the diet variety. So that has cut down on the sugar somewhat, but we are still way over our limit. We guesstimate, and this is just a guess, that we can probably process about 150 to 200 calories a day in added sugar. We are currently at 450 calories a day. So we are over 2.5 times over our limit.
So let's, if you would, explain to the layperson here, Dr. Robert Lustig, about what happens to the sugar, and particularly the high fructose corn syrup that is ubiquitous in food,
right,
and how it's metabolized in the liver and then converted into liver fat, and that apparently is. That's where the rubber meets the road in obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, isn't it?
Well, we think so. Basically, your listeners need to understand that we're first of all talking about added sugar. We're talking about sucrose or table sugar, the white stuff, the stuff you put in your coffee, and we're talking about high fructose corn syrup, the stuff that basically the corn refiners, you know, turn corn into. We're not talking about milk. We're not talking about the sugar in fruit, that's whole fruit. We're being very specific. We are talking about agave, maple syrup, and honey, but they contribute very minor quantities altogether. So we're talking about added sugar. Added sugar is made up of one molecule of glucose. Glucose is the energy of life. Every cell in every organism on the planet runs on glucose. Glucose is so important that if you don't eat it, your body makes it. That's how important it is. And then there's this other molecule called fructose. Fructose is the sweet part of sugar. Glucose is not very interesting. Fructose is way interesting. Fructose is the reason why we seek sugar. Fructose is the whole reason behind why sugar is added to processed foods, because the food industry knows when they add it, you buy more. So what is so special about fructose? Well, from a metabolic standpoint, three things. First, when you overdose your liver on fructose, it has no choice but to turn that fructose into liver fat. And that's a way of exporting it out of the liver, except for one thing. It gets caught. It gets caught in the liver, ends up causing fatty liver, causes insulin resistance, and causes all those downstream diseases that we've just talked about, especially diabetes. And we have now actually published a paper last week, got a lot of press, that shows that sugar directly is involved in the production of diabetes, irrespective of its calories and irrespective of its effects on obesity. Sugar is toxic. That's what we've shown. Number two, sugar binds to proteins, and when it does, it causes the browning reaction. So this is why bananas brown and apples, after you've cut into them, brown, etc. The browning reaction causes cell damage. And it also releases little hydrogen peroxides, which damage the cell and can ultimately cause cell aging and ultimately cell death. Fructose does it 7 times faster than glucose. So you can imagine that if you're consuming a lot of sugar, you're getting a lot of cell damage, and that ultimately translates into disease. And then finally, the third way that sugar, and fructose in particular, is a problem is because your brain thinks you haven't eaten it. It doesn't register, and so you actually get hungrier, and so you end up consuming more. And it happens basically because it works on the hunger center to make you think you want more, and it works on the reward center to make you think you need more. And the bottom line is you end up consuming more, and that is exactly why the food industry has put it in everything. Of the 600,000 items in the American food supply, 80% of them are spiked with added sugar, and that's not because we asked for it. That's because they put it there.
And what are the restraints on them? What are the incentives? Purely the same incentive that a drug dealer has to their clients?
Is it just... Of course, absolutely. Same reason that tobacco was so successful until, you know, it wasn't. The bottom line is we have an area of our brain called the reward center, and it needs reward. And there are different ways it can get reward, but drugs of abuse are one way it gets reward. So tobacco, alcohol, street drugs, cocaine, amphetamine, name it, heroin, you name it. But the bottom line is sugar does exactly the same thing through the same mechanisms, through the same receptors, with the same neurotransmitters that every other single drug of abuse does. It doesn't do it as actively. It's a weaker addictive substance than those guys, but nonetheless addictive, and it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. You can't get away from it. Even if you try to get away from it, you can't, because it's in everything. one half of the sugar you're exposed to, you don't even know you're eating.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist who spent the past 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He's the author of the new book just out, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. So you mentioned the heartbreak of treating young kids that are obese and how
it's terrible.
The social stigmas against them, etc. The difficult lives that they're entering into, mm-hmm. at such a young age. It does, and I know people when they look at overweight kids, they don't look at them with empathy so much as a kind of scorn. You know,
absolutely.
And it's got to be. But isn't there a connection between the fact that so many of these children, their families just simply don't have a lot of money, and that the way our corporate food industries operate is that the cheaper, the more fat and sugar and salt laden the food is, the more it gives the impression of nutrition, and that way the homemaker, usually quite often a single mother, can spread it out further. Can spread the food budget.
Absolutely, this is a war between your wallet and your health. No question about it. One of the reasons processed food has become so prevalent in our society is, number one, it cooks up faster, and time is a major issue, especially with two-parent working families or single, you know, parent families. And number two, you know, there's, I guess, a short-term savings involved, you know, because processed food can, not always, but can be cheaper, certainly not cheaper at the fast food restaurant when you actually total it up, but it can be cheaper, at least in the short run, at home. So ultimately, this is a war between your wallet and your time versus your health. And the question is, which is going to win out? I know where I come down, but, you know, this is a decision that society needs to make together. Because the one thing that's not okay, the one thing that's not right, is for government to subsidize the food and then ultimately subsidize the emergency room visits that come from the food. That's the one thing that can't happen. You can't have it both ways.
But are you saying, Dr. Robert Lustig, that in effect the government is subsidizing the bad food to make it cheap and available and ubiquitous, as opposed to subsidizing the good food, which people can't afford?
That's exactly right. There's no reason that the government should subsidize bad food. I know why they subsidized corn and soy. It made sense back in the 1930s during the Dust Bowl when we had a hungry population and we needed storable food that could be shipped around the entire country. The bottom line is that reason is now gone. We could subsidize real food. We could subsidize broccoli. We could subsidize fruits. We could subsidize virtually almost anything we wanted to subsidize in order to try to improve the health of the country. But we don't. And the reason we don't is because there's money to be made.
And you seem, it feels like you're fighting a pretty lonely battle, I must say.
Not so lonely. There are a lot of people on this on our side. You know, the bottom line is people recognize that if we don't do something about this now, Medicare will be broke by the year 2024. And that's going to be a whole lot worse. We need to deal with this now, and there are plenty of forward-thinking people who want to get ahead of this. You know, kicking the can down the road is how government handles everything, as we've just seen with the, you know, fiscal cliff and the sequester and everything else. We can kick this can down the road, too, but then we won't have Medicare. And you know what? I'm going to be 67 in 2024, and I want my Medicare.
Well, we can see, though, that how the food industry fight back. I mean, there was a modest proposal from Mayor Bloomberg in New York against the sale of, I think, a minor tax on sugary drinks.
Yep. Well, no, what he did was he got rid of the Big Gulp. So the Big Gulp ban is in effect at the moment. Right. And I am totally for that. Now, will that fix obesity? No, of course not. But it's a baby step. It's a step in the right direction. It recognizes that government plays a role in public health and needs to do something in order to actually assist the population when they are not able to assist themselves. Ultimately, this is a fight that has to be brought to the food industry, and individuals, you know, are not powerful enough to do it. But cities, governments, states, they are.
But my sense is, though, that we've been distracted, and we're going down these kind of cul-de-sacs that aren't solving the problem. Like, for example, one of the popular shows on television is, The Biggest Loser, where literally torture a bunch of people to lose weight.
It's a blood sport, isn't it?
and all of this self-help stuff and all of these endless books that are written about diet, and all of them seem to be missing the point that it's not the person who's overweight who's the problem. It's what they ingest that's the problem.
Well, indeed. Well, here's I can sort of sum this issue up in one basic concept. There's a dogma out there that has to be broken, and that dogma goes like this: a calorie is a calorie. Now, if you believe a calorie is a calorie, and there are reasons why people believe that, you know, from the laws of physics, I mean, the first law of thermodynamics, energy can be neither be created nor destroyed, just shifted around. So the standard mantra is, if you eat it, you better burn it or you're going to store it. In other words, you can get your calories from carrots or you can get them from cheesecake. Ultimately, if you eat more than you burn, you're going to gain weight. If you believe that, all is lost, because then the food industry is not culpable. If you believe that, then it's all about diet and exercise, except for one little problem. Diet and exercise don't work. We've been trying it now for 20 years, and it don't work. There is not one study that shows that exercise causes weight loss. Not one. There are plenty of studies that show diet causes weight loss acutely over 6 months, and then everyone gains it back. The number of recidivists approaches 99.5%. Almost no one can keep their weight off, and there are biochemical reasons why, and I actually address all of these in the book. But if you believe that a calorie is not a calorie, if you believe that the quality of those calories, because they're metabolized different, might have different fates in the body, and that certain calories might actually drive weight gain and those chronic metabolic conditions, then the goal is to get rid of those. Now, I'm not the only one who believes that. There are plenty of people who believe that. Gary Taubes wrote a whole book called Good Calories, Bad Calories around this notion. The point is, you are not what you eat. You are what you do with what you eat. And a calorie is not a calorie. And there are certain calories that are particularly egregious. And of those that are egregious, sugar is the big kahuna. And it's the one that has pervaded our entire life, and it is the one that we have to do something about.
And it's almost incomprehensible to think that that the big food companies know this, and that they've used things like low fat and all. You know, they went after fat in the 1970s, but it feels like they just replaced fat with sugar.
That's exactly what they did, because if you take the fat out of the food, food tastes like cardboard. It tastes terrible. The flavor was in the fat. You know, as an example, try milk. You know, whole milk. You know, I grew up on whole milk. I mean, a lot of people in this country grew up on whole milk. You know what? We drank it. We drank it at school, and no one complained. And then we took the fat out of the milk because everybody went, quote, low fat. The fat was bad. And then all of a sudden the milk tasted like, you know, dishwater. And so what did they have to do? They had to add chocolate. So now we have chocolate milk. So the question I put to you, Ian, is which was worse for you, the fat or the sugar?
Well, that's the choice that's killing us, right?
I mean, well, that is the choice that's killing us, and we need to redo that. I will tell you right now, without question, mark my words, the fat hypothesis has been debunked. Now what we need to do is we need to reassess our diet in a meaningful way. But you know what? We haven't done it. The USDA hasn't done it. The Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee hasn't done it. You know, and there's reasons. It's called politics. It's called money. You know, there's a lot riding on this. There's billions and billions and billions of dollars riding on this via the Farm Bill, via food subsidies, via the SNAP program, and ultimately, you know, through the food industry. This is the battle royal of the 21st century, and we got to win it.
Well, Dr. Robert Lustig, I thank you so much for your book, because that is the ammunition that we need in the fight.
Oh, yeah.
And I appreciate your joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, who's a pediatric endocrinologist who spent the past 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He's the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at the University of California, San Francisco, Benioff Children's Hospital. He's a member of the UCSF Institute for Health Policy Studies and a member of the Obesity Task Force of both the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. His latest book just out is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the increasing backlog of judicial nominees from the Obama administration who are being routinely filibustered by Republican senators. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California. His books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
And Caitlin Halligan, who's a prominent New York lawyer, she has been rejected for a second time. She was nominated by President Obama to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And they simply wouldn't. She got a 51-41 vote, but that's well short of the filibuster. That's the threshold that the Republicans is now requiring. Well, first of all, what strikes me as being incredibly important about this, isn't this the same court, the key court, that feeds cases to the Supreme Court? And indeed, many of its members go on to sit on the Supreme Court. And didn't this court recently strike down President Obama's recess appointments?
Yes, and answered all the questions you just posed. The D.C. Circuit is a particularly important court because it reviews what the administrative agencies do in Washington, often reviews what the executive branch of government does. Many of the judges in the D.C. Circuit have gone on to the Supreme Court. Antonin Scalia, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Clarence Thomas, and most recently John Roberts. We're all judges on the D.C. Circuit before going on to the United States Supreme Court. And finally, it is this court that handed down the astounding ruling that a president can fill vacancies through recess appointments only if the vacancy occurs during that congressional recess. That goes against 200 years of practice. In fact, Earl Warren, William Brennan, Potter Stewart were all recess appointments that would have been illegitimate under the D.C. Circuit approach.
Well, didn't President Obama nominate Caitlin Halligan for the seat vacated by the current Chief Justice Roberts?
That's correct. Remember, John Roberts went on the Supreme Court in 2005. This seat has not been filled, and we're 2013. The Republicans filibustered Caitlin Halligan during the prior Obama term and did so again yesterday. And there's only one explanation for why they did this. And that's that the National Rifle Association strongly opposed her confirmation. She had participated in a civil suit against gun manufacturers, and as a result, the NRA deemed her unacceptable. There is nothing in her background other than that that causes anyone to question her being on the court. No one, not even the senators who filibuster, question her qualifications or her competence.
But surely, Erwin Chemerinsky, the fact that the seat that she was nominated for, and this is the second time she's been filibustered by the Republicans, it's been vacant since 2005 when John Roberts moved to the Supreme Court, and now, what is it now, 8 years later, it's still vacant. What is the overall backlog of President Obama's judicial appointments? Because my sense is that this is a part of the inherent strategy on the part of the Republicans, why they require filibusters, whether the excuse is the NRA or whatever they come up with. That's not the point, surely. This is a way to slant the judiciary in their direction.
You're absolutely right. The United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit is very closely balanced between conservatives and liberals who are on active status. The Republicans don't want to give a Democratic president another seat on the D.C. Circuit, so they're simply holding it up. The irony here is when the Democrats were filibustering President George W. Bush's nominees, the Republicans threatened the nuclear option and said they would eliminate the filibuster entirely. The Democrats caved. Among other things, they confirmed a very conservative judge, Janice Rogers Brown, for that court. And the Democrats agreed not to use the filibuster other than exceptional circumstances. However, now what you're seeing is the Republicans are aggressively filibustering President Obama's picks, including for the D.C. Circuit.
So what does that say about the Democrats then? Why are they so supine?
I wish I had the answer to why the Democrats won't do or at least threaten what the Republicans did to get their judicial nominees through. The Republicans said to the Democrats, if you keep filibustering our picks, we'll just eliminate the filibuster, the nuclear option. And the Democrats caved. Why don't the Democrats threaten the same thing as to the Republicans?
Well, I think there was at least a movement on the part of some of the younger Democratic senators in the U.S. Senate. In fact, that was the first order of business after the recent election when they came back into the Senate. And they were basically the older guard, the Harry Reids, essentially said they'll have filibuster reform without the nuclear option. And look where we are.
And I hope that the Democrats will reconsider that. I think there are many ways of changing the filibuster, but I think what we have now is just unacceptable. The Republicans wouldn't stand for it when there's a Republican president. The Democrats shouldn't stand for somebody like Caitlin Halligan with impeccable credentials being blocked now.
So what are you hearing from the White House, Erwin Chemerinsky, in terms of what their next move is? This is, after all, the second time this qualified judge has been filibustered by the Republicans, and this is a key court, as we mentioned, and the seat has been vacant now for the last 8 years. I believe there are other seats on this court, aren't there, that are vacant as well? In other words,
there are other vacancies, and other superbly qualified individuals have been filibustered. Take Goodwin Liu, who's a professor at the University of California Berkeley School of Law, who was nominated by President Obama for the Ninth Circuit. He was filibustered, and then Governor Jerry Brown put him on the California Supreme Court, where he sits today. There were more filibusters during President Obama's first term than ever before in American history. And I favor careful deliberation, but not obstructionism like this.
Well, ironically, of course, they've just had a filibuster, a real filibuster, going back to the movie Mr. Smith Comes to Washington, involving Rand Paul and a few other Republican senators and one Democrat, Ron Wyden, joined in. But my understanding of that was largely theatrical, that the objections that Rand Paul had already previously been dealt with, and subsequently he's been given another letter from the White House saying that there's really no substance to his objections. And even the Wall Street Journal editorial came out with a stinging rebuke of Rand Paul, as did Senator John McCain on the floor of the Senate today. So it's a bit odd, isn't it, that you actually have a filibuster that's a storm in a teacup, but you have these real filibusters that have real consequences, and they've been going on for a long time.
The Senate rules were changed to allow what we would think of as a virtual filibuster. If a senator indicates that he or she is going to filibuster, then unless there's 60 votes to bring the matter to a vote, it doesn't come for a vote. So that's why you don't usually see the filibuster where a member of the Senate stands on the floor for 13 hours. Rand Paul yesterday did that old time, as you say, Mr. Smith goes to Washington type filibuster. But those are rare. What the Senate has done is evolved to a body where you need 60 votes to pass something. That's inconsistent with a Constitution that says majority rule, and the Constitution specifies when it wants it to have to be more than that in a Senate or a House vote.
So just back to the, I know I threw a whole bunch of questions at you, Owen, but the, what is President Obama going to do now? This is his appointment. It's the second time. She's obviously highly qualified, and there are other open seats on this very key court as well. He's basically, there's no way in the world that he does not recognize that this is a slap in the face to him and that this situation is absolutely unsupportable.
I don't know what President Obama is going to do. His administration hasn't said. With regard to Goodwin Liu, he withdrew his nomination and President Obama appointed someone else. It may be that President Obama and Caitlin Halligan will give up. There were only 51 votes yesterday to end the filibuster, and President Obama will then just move on to a different nominee. But it is very troubling to me that somebody with impeccable qualifications could be blocked, and not because of anything about what she's done in her life, nothing about what she said. It's entirely because she participated in a civil suit against gun companies. That's the only thing that anyone can identify as to why she was filibustered, that the NRA very strongly opposes her because of that. And to me, that's tremendously troubling.
But didn't we start out earlier in the Obama administration with Dawn Johnson being blocked? And I've interviewed her before, and she seems like an extremely qualified jurist.
Dawn is a professor at Indiana University. She had previously worked in the Office of Legal Counsel. She was nominated by President Obama to be the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel. She was blocked because early in her career, before she even became a law professor, she had been the legal director for NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League. And because of that, she was filibustered, not because of anything else in terms of her competence or ability.
So I know we're talking about two different things, appointments at Justice Department and the federal judiciary, which is highly stacked with the Republican jurists, simply because the Republicans have controlled the executive branch for quite a few years, and mostly because in the Obama administration, they've succeeded in blocking so many of his nominations. Do you actually know the figures? My understanding is that it's pretty shocking how few people Obama's gotten through compared to how many George W. Bush got through.
The statistics are stunning. And if you go to a website that's done by the Alliance for Justice in Washington, D.C., they have all of those statistics on their website.
But just as a thumb sketch, do you have any recollection of what the numbers are, the ratio between how many people Bush got on the court and how few people Obama has managed to get on the court?
It's quite stunning, but I don't know the number.
So we've looked at that website that you just mentioned, and let me just read from it. During President Obama's time in office, current vacancies have risen by 58%. This trend stands in stark contrast to the comparable point in President Clinton and President Bush's second term, when vacancies had declined by 51% and 13%, respectively. Over 10% of all federal judgeships are vacant. Judicial vacancies are more than double what they were at this point in George W. Bush's second term. So just to turn to the Attorney General, Eric Holder, who has not, in the eyes of a lot of people, been particularly zealous, particularly on prosecuting malfeasance on Wall Street. After all, the entire economy was taken to the brink of a near-death experience. The taxpayers had to bail out Wall Street, make them whole. They're stronger than ever. And now, just in the last couple of days in hearings, the Attorney General made the extraordinary statement that some of these too big to fail banks were headed up by CEOs who were too big to jail. Because if you were to put them in jail, you would somehow hurt the overall economy. And I find that extraordinary that the chief law enforcement officer of the United States should be concerned about the economic implications of justice.
I find it deeply offensive. There's a very important principle in this country that no one is above the law. That includes the president. It includes the head of Fortune 500 companies. It includes you and Nate. When you look at how aggressive the federal government is, often in prosecuting people for very minor crimes, especially drug crimes, the idea that people who can cost others billions of dollars through fraud and through illegal activities would be above the law is just not acceptable. I have a client who was sentenced to 50 years to life for stealing $153 worth of videotapes. If somebody steals billions of dollars from the economy, surely they deserve to be punished, too, if they're violating the law.
Well, his Deputy Attorney General, under Eric Holder, Lanny Brewer, of course, was a subject, not the subject, but he certainly didn't come across very well in a recent PBS Frontline special called The Untouchables, which posed the question, why hasn't there been any significant jail time for those on Wall Street who all but destroyed the economy and have been made whole while the economy, as you well know, is still languishing. And Lanny Brewer did not equip himself well in this documentary, and he quickly thereafter, it was on television, he resigned. Apparently he's going back to Wall Street. What are the chances of anybody replacing Eric Holder? Do you have any sense of whether there's going to be an opening at the Attorney General's position and whether somebody, a more zealous appointee, could take over?
There was a lot of speculation after President Obama's re-election about which cabinet officers would leave after the first term, since Hillary Clinton stepped down, Hilda Solis from Labor stepped down. Many thought that Eric Holder might resign. It hasn't happened yet. And if it happens, then it's anyone's guess as to who President Obama would pick to head the Justice Department.
Well, already Elizabeth Warren, who's becoming a very popular senator, and she's already expressed her absolute dismay at what Eric Holder said in regard to bankers being too big to jail. So the word is out there. A lot of people are wondering why the Justice Department has been so feckless.
I don't know why Eric Holder said that. I think it was an offensive statement. It cannot be that anybody is too big to jail in a country that believes that no one is above the law.
Well, Erwin Chemerinsky, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Erwin Chemerinsky, who's a founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California. His books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.